This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and today I'm talking to Michael Kimmage about Collisions, the Origins of the War in Ukraine and the New Global Instability, published today as a Kindle book by Oxford University Press and as a physical book on March the 22nd. Quote, after a few anomalous years of peace, Europe became in 2022 what it's always been, an epicenter of conflict, the fault line around which the biggest and worst geopolitical earthquakes tend to occur. A member of the Secretary's policy planning staff at the US State Department, where he handled the Ukraine-Russia portfolio from 2014 to 16, Michael Kimmage is now a professor of history at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Including Collisions, he is the author of four books, most recently in 2020, The Abandonment of the West. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
My first question is, why Collisions?
The title, I think, speaks to first of all, just the fact of war, the collision of armies and the collision of military hardware. But if it were only that, it could be in the singular. And the title of the book is a plural noun, collisions. And by that, I mean that there is really a nested quality to this conflict, and that is, it is at least three conflicts in one. The first being between Russia and Ukraine, the immediate war. The second being between Russia and Europe, because this is a conflict about Ukraine's place in Europe, and about what Europe signifies to Russia, what Russia signifies to Europe. And thirdly, this is a conflict between the United States and Russia, which in some ways harkens back to the Cold War, in some ways is very different from the Cold War. But the U.S. is deeply involved in the conflict, to be sure, and an important element of Russian strategy and a Russian sort of attitude toward Ukraine is Ukraine's relationship to the United States. So there are three dimensions, each of them quite different. And I don't think that we can get a good sense or a good grasp of the war if we look at it as only a singular collision. I think it must be looked at as multiple collisions.
Okay, so obviously the origins of the war go right back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but you identify a more immediate trigger in the book as 2008 onwards. And you write that, quote, Europe was a magical place in 2008, but there were early signs that this was wearing off. So can you expand on that?
Yes, I'd begin the book with the joint optimism of Angela Merkel and Barack Obama. And this was, you know, sort of a period of political transition that was viewed in Berlin and Washington as basically very positive. Of course, you have the financial crisis of 2008, which is a different storyline. But there was a remarkable optimism about European integration. And this is very reasonable given the preceding history. From 1991 to 2008, Europe had integrated dramatically, overcome a lot of its historical tribulations and difficulties. And there was, you know, there were many reasons to expect that this process would go on continuously. And for Merkel and Obama both, Ukraine was perhaps secondary in 2008, but there was a sense that Russia at a certain point would integrate into Europe and that countries like Ukraine would integrate into Europe. And this led in 2009 to something called the Eastern Partnership Program, an EU program for six post-Soviet states, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. And this was a program to bring them gently, moderately, gradually into the orbit of the European Union. And it was really based upon the optimism that I've just been describing. So without going further in the story, what does happen by 2012, 2013 is that the Eastern Partnership Program leads to something called the Association Agreement between Ukraine and the European Union. And there's a kind of dance that's going on in 2012, 2013 about whether Ukraine will join or not join. And Ukraine's then president, Viktor Yanukovych, signals that he could join the with the association agreement, not join the EU, but become closer to the EU. And then sort of at the last moment, he pulls out. And there's a summit meeting in Vilnius that he goes to, and he doesn't sign the association agreement. And then he comes back to Kiev, and there are very substantial protests in Kiev that react to this decision of Yanukovych's. I'll sort of stop there, but these protests set in motion a revolution that's going to occur within Ukraine. And that revolution in turn begins a story of military conflict that is the necessary prehistory to the 2022 war.
Yeah, I find your description of Obama and Merkel as a power tandem is really interesting. Do you feel that they really were the dominant players in this kind of willful blindness regarding Putin's Russia?
Yes, I have empathy for them because it's very difficult to disentangle a lot of the strands that were tied up in 2008, 2009. One of them, and this is a crucial episode to go over in detail, is that you have Dmitry Medvedev, who's the president of Russia from 2008 to 2012. And one could not know in 2008 that he would be edged out by Vladimir Putin, that Putin would return and take the country in quite a different direction in 2012. But the rhetoric, at least, of Medvedev, however powerful he was or was not, the rhetoric of Medvedev was to integrate Russia into the global economy, to integrate Russia into Europe. And Medvedev really foregrounded questions of economics and technology. His nickname in Russia was Little iPhone. And he made a pilgrimage to Silicon Valley, where he opened his Twitter account with the directors of Twitter standing in attendance. And I think it was not crazy to build a set of expectations upon a figure like Medvedev that were fairly benign. So it's not as if Merkel and Obama missed something that was obvious, but by 2012, you have a different leader in Russia, and it starts to travel. Russia itself starts to travel in a different direction. And then I do view the events in Ukraine in 2013 and 2014 as, to a degree, accidental. So they create a very, very rapid series of changes, to which I think, in the end, Obama and Merkel responded to very poorly. But one does have to have empathy for the contingent nature of some of these transitions. Had Ukraine not had this revolution, I think there would have been sour relationships between Putin's Russia and the West. But I don't think that we would have the series of wars that we've had in the last 10 or so years. So yes, Obama and Merkel missed a lot. But when you go back and reconstruct their world and their environment, you know, you could blandly say that they were doing the best they could.
Well, going slightly off topic, but I can't resist it. You talked there about Medvedev, and he's such a diminished figure now. Did you get any inkling of that when you were in the State Department, that what was his transformation?
Well, I joined the State Department in late 2014, so that was 2 years into, you know, the kind of post-Medvedev Putin term, and so all of our attention was focused on the figure of Putin, and Medvedev was at that point a has-been, as he sort of remained. I think it was possible to discern, you know, certainly this was the word on the street in many different places, that Medvedev was a rather weak figure, that he was there to do Putin's bidding, that he was potentially a kind of puppet of Putin's. But, you know, in a sense, it's easier to make that judgment in hindsight. I think what's most remarkable about Medvedev is maybe not so much that he has sputtered out. I don't think he's ever been anything much more than a kind of political mediocrity. But what's remarkable about him is that the position that he took, sincerely or insincerely, between 2008 and 2012 was really quite a pro-Western position, as if he needed to modernize Russia along Western lines. That's the message that he was sending to Russians and to people abroad. Now he's become stridently nationalistic and, you know, sort of profoundly anti-Ukrainian. And there's a kind of tone of voice that he uses, especially on Twitter, that's just sometimes startlingly incoherent, but just startling. As such, it's just not the man that he was, or not the man that he seemed to be between 2008 and 2012. That's the evolution that I think is the most intriguing one.
As I said, the book really gets going from 2008, but now we've established that backdrop, I'd like actually to go a bit further back to 1999, Putin coming to power, and the experience of the NATO intervention in Kosovo and the changing of the borders of Serbia. You and you're not the first person to write this, but you do stress what a formative moment that was for Putin's thinking.
Yes, if you'll allow me, I'll sort of develop a continuum here. It's 1999, Kosovo, but it's also the Iraq War, and then it's the NATO intervention in Libya. All three of these events are very significant data points for Putin's thinking and for the thinking of the Russian political elite, national security elite, about where Russia stands and about the kind of power that the United States wields. And I think this is such crucial intellectual backdrop to the decision to invade Ukraine in 2022 that it demands careful articulation. So I think in a Russian reading of 1999, the issue is not just that NATO was there and not just that NATO was poised to expand as it would very dramatically in 2004. I think that the issue is that NATO goes out of area into Serbia and uses its military hard power to refashion the borders of the Balkans. And so NATO is technically a defensive military alliance, but it wasn't really behaving as such in former Yugoslavia. And that was really upsetting to Russia. Beyond bonds of affection between Russia and Serbia, I think that that's actually a bit secondary, but it's more that NATO appeared to be taking on a new role in Europe. Second data point of the Iraq War, which really does follow on this moment of 1999, is that the United States wages war in Iraq and before that in Afghanistan, you know, without much of a UN, you know, sort of legitimacy, without the authority of the UN behind it. Colin Powell with his famous address to the UN about weapons of mass destruction. And so here you have a somewhat more ambitious United States that's writing its own rules in the Middle East, not just in Europe, and acting in the Russian interpretation with impunity and removing from Russia one of Russia's most important foreign policy tools, which is its veto on the UN Security Council. So that's, you know, quite significant. And then it happens again under Medvedev's watch in 2011 in Libya, when NATO involves itself in a bombing campaign in Libya. And that's with the acquiescence of Russia, which abstains at the United Nations, and that becomes a point of friction between Medvedev, who was then Russia's president, and Putin. The two of them squabble openly about whether Russia should have abstained or not. So I think all of this signifies in the kind of culture, the thinking of Russian national security elites, a United States that's becoming more and more emboldened and sort of lurching closer to Russia and depriving Russia of some of its key foreign policy and military tools. And of course, just to finish the point, 2014-2022 manifests quite considerable pushback on Russia's part against what they see as this negative and disturbing trend.
On that same score, there's a quote from the book where you say, quote, NATO enlargement proceeded on the unwise premise that NATO expansion was itself resolving the problem of Eastern European security. In truth, by expanding, NATO was absorbing the age-old problem of Eastern European security in the 1990s and thereafter. Now, I take that not as an argument that some make that NATO expansion was a mistake, but that NATO was expanded from the wrong premise. People weren't thinking straight about what they were doing.
That's my interpretation, and this is a much debated topic, and many others would argue to the contrary, that every inch of NATO expansion was wise because it provided a kind of protection that if it weren't there, that Russia would contest. In other words, if NATO had not expanded to the Baltic republics, they would be in play now, as Ukraine is. And so any NATO expansion is in and of itself a good thing. But I do take a different view on that point. And I think that there is a profound difference in role for NATO between Cold War NATO, and of course, NATO is a Cold War institution created in the late 1940s, and post-Cold War NATO. And, you know, sort of get in a moment to this notion of NATO absorbing age-old regional and ethnic and national conflicts. But let me start with the Cold War NATO. Cold War NATO is brilliantly designed. And that's one of the reasons why it's going to be so effective from 1949 to 1989 or 1991. And it was brilliantly designed because it was a set of countries that very much wished to be a part of the alliance and that contributed to the alliance. And it was a set of countries that had a kind of internal coherence. You have the Iron Curtain. In effect, what NATO was defending in Europe was everything on the Western side of the Iron Curtain. And the Iron Curtain is contested at the beginning of the Cold War. There are all these Berlin crises. But by, let's say, the late 50s, 1960s, the Iron Curtain is there and is not really very unclear. And so NATO had the job of defending the NATO member states. It was extremely clear what that job was. And NATO's function was to deter the Soviet Union, which it did brilliantly. After the end of the Cold War, of course, you had this optimism that we were discussing a moment ago, that everything is integrating and the world is becoming one and Europe is kind of joining together and it's moving past its historic problems, 20th century, pre-20th century problems. That in the end proved to be quite naive, and it proved to be quite naive directly in relation to NATO expansion. So NATO goes in this very incoherent way forward. It's some of the countries in the Balkans, right? It's not Serbia, but it is Montenegro. It's some of the countries in Eastern and Central Europe. It's Poland, but it's not Belarus. It's Romania and Bulgaria, but not Ukraine. And you have this little island of Kaliningrad, which is Russian territory, that's tucked within two NATO states, Poland and Lithuania. And then you have the additional confusion that NATO makes the claim in 2008 that it's going to expand into Georgia and Ukraine, you know, not the most sincere or believable of claims, but nevertheless one that was made. And so you just don't know. Where does NATO end? And who would, in their right minds, create such a structure that's so jagged and confusing? And so that makes questions of deterrence and defense and NATO as a defensive alliance just a lot more complicated. And so what NATO ended up absorbing is the incredible security dilemmas of Eastern and Central Europe, cause of countless wars from the 17th century to the present. And NATO is sort of smack in the middle of it, not far away, and struggling at the very moment to understand whether it's deterring Russia or whether it's actively involved in Ukraine. And that's just not a great state of affairs for NATO, I would say.
So you set the scene for the development of Putin's thinking between 2008 and 2013. And I want to come in with another quote from the book where you say, quote, "Over time, the low comedy of Yanukovych's escape came to resemble the curious drama of Archduke Ferdinand's assassination in June 1914, a seemingly random occurrence on Europe's periphery, an accident that somehow precipitated a major European war." Is the point you're making there that this was decisive because it was the end of any hope that Putin had that he could manage Ukraine back into the Russian base through his client in Kyiv?
No, I don't think that is quite over in 2014. And the simple fact that Russia doesn't invade or reinvade between 2015, when the active fighting ceases, and 2022 is a sign that Russia was sort of making up its mind, trying to figure out what would happen. And I think that there was a hope in Moscow that somebody like Yanukovych, or maybe Yanukovych himself, would come back. That, you know, Ukraine since 1991 had vacillated. It had been more pro-Russian at times, more pro-European at times, and that the pendulum would again swing back toward Russia, which didn't prove to be the case. You know, you have an election in Ukraine in 2019 that Zelensky wins and he runs as a peace candidate. I think a little burst of optimism in Moscow that maybe he's somebody that Russia could do business with, but that gets disappointed pretty quickly. But still, I think, you know, a lot is open still after 2014, 2015. I think the way in which the flight of Yanukovych to Russia, this is the evening of February 21st, 2014, early morning hours, he first goes to Kharkiv and then to Crimea and then to Russia, I think it does resemble the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in the sense that it reminds us how important certain contingencies are. You know, you could imagine that Europe was destined inevitably for the First World War. There are historians who make that argument, but still, you know, I think the First World War begins in this disbelief, and it's not as if anybody really wished to have a world war in 1914. It somehow happens. It gets triggered by some insecurity, some moment of insecurity and stability that then proves impossible to contain. And I think 2014 is very much like that. It is not fully a point of no return. There are ways in which it could have been brought back, perhaps, to the much more peaceful order that was there before February 2014, when Yanukovych makes his escape. But after 2014, to a degree, the die is cast. And the collision course, you know, to go back to my title, the kind of collisions that I'm speaking about, Russia-Ukraine, Russia-Europe, Russia-United States, the collision course is apparent already in 2014. It's there. You can see that it could go in that direction. And that, to me, is what's so significant about that moment. But I would want to underscore the accidental nature of it. That, I think, takes us back to the terrain, the kind of international terrain of the early 20th century.
The point you make very clearly is that while the collision course, has become clear. It's not become clear to the French and Germans, for example. So that you make a very good point about their role in the Minsk negotiations. That essentially they really only saw themselves as facilitators. You point out that Merkel had ruled out military force in any circumstance, and that meant that the Russians called the shots. It was their action or their inaction that determined everything.
Absolutely. This is a psychological disjunction. I think we're still living with this disjunction, but it was quite acute in 2014 and 2015. Between a Russia that did believe that it had started what was truly a war, it paused in 2015. And I said a moment ago that Russia hoped that Ukraine would kind of tilt back toward Russia and that it could keep its relationship to the West intact. But it had taken a very, very significant step, Russia, by annexing Crimea and planting its military forces in eastern Ukraine. So it had taken a step toward war. And psychologically, I don't know if the Russian population was there, but I think the Kremlin elite was in that frame of mind. And you have Russia moving into Syria in 2015, and you have Russian intervention in American domestic politics in 2015, 2016. So these are other steps that take us toward greater confrontation between Russia and the West. But the disjunction is that this wasn't really felt on the other side of the barricades or the other side of the trenches. And I think that this is as true for Washington as it would be for London, Berlin, or Paris. When it comes to the diplomacy of 2014, 2015, it was France and Germany that were in the driver's seat. And I think what was so, in a way, unimpressive about that kind of diplomacy was in part the naivete, the sense that it was all over, that we had kind of moved through the worst of the crisis and now we're just mopping up. There was that sentiment with the subsiding of fighting in 2014. 2015, but it's worse than that on the Western side. So the West was very clear about the conditions it was setting. Crimea was fudged, and I think reading between the lines, Crimea was kind of accepted as something that would be Russian in perpetuity, maybe unfair, illegitimate against international law, but, you know, sanctioned and then to a degree forgotten. But the Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine was different. And there, the transatlantic position was crystal clear that they should get out. And they needed to leave. There needed to be elections in those regions, and those regions needed to be restored to a sovereign and independent Ukraine. There's no ambiguity about that position, whether we're speaking about François Hollande, the president of France, or Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, or Barack Obama, the American president. And yet it didn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, you know, the sanctions are not increased. The sanctions are kind of left to dissipate in effectiveness. And then each of these countries, France, Germany, and the U.S., and I think the U.K. is in the same category, you know, gradually begin to normalize their relations with Russia. So conditions had been set, you know, a sort of tough stance was taken, and then it was, you know, acted upon without toughness, without focus, without discipline. And in that sense, you know, there was a refusal to recognize how grave the situation was in Ukraine, and that gave Russia a lot of tactical advantages pre-2022.
Well, coming forward to the Trump presidency, and you pull absolutely no punches during your chapter on that, but you do make a very interesting point for somebody who was in the Obama administration, which was that Trump, given where he is now in the position of the Republican Party on Ukraine, if he'd actually exercised some self-discipline, he could have imposed his will on Ukraine. He could have forced a settlement at Crimea, maybe along the lines of what the Ukrainians were prepared to accept at the Istanbul negotiation. And he could have made a commitment that Ukraine could never join NATO.
Yes, it is a very interesting question with Trump. I mean, he's a hard man to decipher. I don't envy the historians in the future who are going to have to write about him, because it's just difficult to know what's real and what's true, both with Trump himself, but also in the Trump years. But, you know, I like the question very much. It's an interesting hypothetical. In a sense, if Trump had made good on some of the stuff that he discussed on the campaign trail in 2016, so he made a real point of not demonizing Putin and Russia. He sort of suggested that Russia had a lot of legitimate interests in Ukraine, and that the West, the United States and Europe, had overstepped and provoked Russia into, you know, sort of unfortunate acts in 2014, 2015. And Trump had very little sympathy for Ukraine. So whether you agree or disagree with those positions, he's somebody who could have done business with Putin, to be sure. And he suggested that he wanted to, and that he could resolve these crises and kind of move on to things that were more important, you know, U.S. competition with China or the domestic American economy, things that mattered more to Trump than, you know, the territorial integrity of Ukraine, but none of that happens. And not only does it not happen, but you never see Trump put forward a set of ideas that he could have used to move in that direction. He doesn't outline an agenda in 2016, 2017, 2018 that could have been shared with Russia. Now, maybe some of this was attempted covertly, and we'll get that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now from historians who open the archives. But my guess is he never really tried. And it's interesting why that would be the case. Did he not care? Was this kind of campaign talk that wasn't really seriously intended? Did he get tangled up in the Russia investigations and the you know, the domestic chaos surrounding issues related to Russia in 2016, 2017? That's, you know, sort of possible. Was he not able to command his own bureaucracy and then had too many people, General Mattis and McMaster and Tillerson and others who were pulling in a different direction? You know, all of that is possible. But the simple fact is that those years are four lost years. There's just nothing attempted, nothing tried, nothing done, whether it was arming Ukraine in some comprehensive fashion or whether it was diplomacy that would lead to a, you know, kind of neutral Ukraine. You know, there's no activity.
Finally, coming to the full-scale invasion itself, how decisive do you think the Afghan pullout and the AUKUS debacle with the French were in convincing Putin that the time was right now?
I don't think it's hugely important. I don't think AUKUS plays a particularly prominent role. I might expand some of the contributing factors a bit. I think that the passing of Angela Merkel from the scene is not a necessary condition for the war, but something of a condition for the war. Europe is in a leadership transition phase in 2019-2020. I do think that January 6th and the sense that the U.S. is in a period, a sort of a moment of chronic political, you know, sort of chaos or dysfunction, sort of not able to carry out its business, I think that that plays something of a role. And I do think Afghanistan, but I would put Afghanistan a little bit more broadly than the messy pullout in August 2021. You know, if you want to take an uncharitable read of Afghanistan, which I'm sure Putin does when it comes to the U.S., it would go as follows, that September 11th creates the reason for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2022. And the U.S. goes in to kind of eviscerate the Taliban and make a September 11th, a second September 11th impossible. And what happens over time is that the U.S. doesn't really get there militarily or politically and ends up negotiating its own military exit from Afghanistan with the Taliban. So the U.S. goes in with these big ambitions and kind of leaves with its tail between its legs. And I think that that was mapped on to Ukraine for Putin as a distinct possibility. And I think that that played a role in his thinking about the war. This is the kind of power that the United States has become. It was high and mighty in the 1990s, but it's become a diminished power. It doesn't make good on its promises. It loses its, you know, patience and pulls away from situations that are difficult. And if that's the truth of Afghanistan, that will be the truth of Ukraine. And I think was a contributing factor. But I should say, just as a footnote, that none of us has any evidence on this question. None of us really knows when Putin made the decision. It could have been 5 years ago. You know, some people think that he'd made the decision to invade in February 2022, a few weeks before the invasion itself, in which case, you know, AUKUS, Afghanistan, January 6th would be, you know, very much secondary factors and features. But I would put, you know, sort of composite U.S. frustrations on the international stage, changes in leadership, domestic political problems in the U.S., you know, plus, you know, whatever Putin's reading of Biden was in that summer, all of that has to matter.
Well, I come to the conclusion of the book, which are really thought-provoking, and I'll start with really a question around where you say, quote, Russia's relations with the West will be conflictual for a long time to come. There must now be the governing assumption, given the compromises Moscow will need, an end to military support for Ukraine, permanent ceding of Crimea and eastern Donbass, and a generalized freeze on NATO expansion, that these can't be met. So how would you see this conflictual relationship playing out?
Well, I'll give you two scenarios, a worst case scenario and a better case scenario. I don't think that there are any good scenarios for this war, even if it would end tomorrow. It's such a horrific event. It's, as I try to characterize in the book, really a tragedy, first and foremost for the people of Ukraine, but for Russia too. for Europe, really for the world. It's a tragic event. So there aren't good scenarios, but there are better and worse scenarios. But I'll start with the worst scenario, which is that, Russia has very substantial ambitions with Ukraine. And I think what Russia has learned to do over the course of the last 2 years is not only to act with a degree of effectiveness militarily in Ukraine. The news of the last couple of weeks certainly confirms that point. But Russia has also globalized the war. And it has found levers of global influence to complicate things for the West, for backers and supporters of Ukraine, but also to advance its own interests. So the Russian economy is functioning because Russia has found all kinds of channels, avenues into the global economy. And, Russia is getting military support of a substantial kind from North Korea and from Iran that may be, determining the momentum of the battlefield at the present moment. And I think that also Russia has been pretty capable with its messaging, to global audiences. So Russia has found ways to globalize the war. It's found ways to fight the war over the long haul. And I think its ambitions are really quite considerable. And those ambitions are not ambitions that the West can accept or work with in some simple diplomatic fashion. So I think that they do dictate, as I argue, and as you quote from the book, a generational conflict, a conflict that will last for years, but probably a conflict that will last for decades. And the worst case scenario is that this conflict would somehow spin out of control, that it would draw neighboring countries into it, that there would be a nuclear component, that accident or perhaps the design of various actors, given the complexity of things, could push us toward conflict. Going back to an earlier part of our conversation, we have this island of Kaliningrad that's there on the Baltic Sea, bordering Poland and Lithuania. That has to be provisioned. You have a rail line that goes through Lithuania with Russian soldiers going to Kaliningrad. That's a very sensitive place. And there are a lot of things that could just go wrong by accident. And that could take us toward something really resembling a European-wide war. And that would be the worst case scenario for this. The better case scenario, and I think this is what I would recommend and urge upon strategists in London, in Washington, and throughout Europe, is to be prepared for a kind of long-term commitment, and at the same time to seek out certain rules of engagement. In a way, this takes us back to the early Cold War. You had high levels of conflict between the West and the Soviet Union, and lots that was scary, anarchic, and difficult to control, but they did manage to sort of figure out where to fight and where not to fight. And so perhaps rules of engagement can be discovered over time if the kind of mental and political toughness is there to think them through. You'll have a line of contact somewhere in or near Ukraine. Russia's not going to pull back from its own ambitions, but it will have met a kind of limit to those ambitions. And then the active phases of the war might start to die down. Some people dream of a sort of armistice or a kind of Korea-type situation down the road, and that might be the best thing that we could hope for. So not an elimination of the conflict, and not that heads of state can kind of sit down and figure everything out. I don't think that that's going to work unless there would be big leadership changes in Russia, but rules of engagement, sort of a moderation of the fighting, a slowing down of the war such that a degree of normalcy returns to the region, that may be feasible, and that's probably the best that that could be hoped for.
You do identify, though, a real potential flashpoint, which is Belarus. As you say, quote, given the extreme distrust between Russia and the West, Belarus finds itself in the zero-sum logic of the Ukraine war. It will be either Europe or Russia. It cannot be both. And as you point out, you can have a situation, as you described there, where the powers learn to stand off from each other.
Yeah.
This is a situation where it's not entirely up to them. It's also up to the people of Belarus. If they were to rise up against Lukashenko or against his successor, it would be very difficult to stay out of that. And it would be very important strategically to the Ukraine.
Absolutely. No, Belarus is one of the staging grounds for the Russian invasion in 2022. And in a way, a lot of the nightmares that we could have about the coming years revolve around Belarus. The Western position is humane and understandable, and a bit confusing at the same time, that the government of Belarus is not acknowledged as the legitimate government of Belarus. The 2020 election, which did yield a wave of protests in Belarus back then, is understood to have been illegitimate, unfair, which of course it was, and that the real government of Belarus is sitting in Vilnius or somewhere else. So exactly as you say, if there were to be upheaval in Belarus and Lukashenko were to fall, his health doesn't look, you know, terrific, and he's built Belarus into a very unpleasant dictatorship, so there's lots of incentive to get rid of him and to move toward a better political system. But that would immediately bring in geopolitics, and it would bring in the Baltic republics and Poland, and whatever element of involvement they would have would be seen in Moscow as totally illegitimate. And of course, the country of Belarus is in many ways already integrated into Russia, and especially the militaries of Belarus and Russia are deeply intertwined, as are the security services and other institutions. So it's not as if Russia needs to look for military assets in Belarus. Russia is much, much more present militarily in Belarus than it was in Ukraine in 2014 or 2022. So how do you get out of that situation? How do you negotiate your way out of that situation? How do you fight your way out of that situation? It's really combustible. And of course, Belarus borders three NATO member states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. So it's not just a regional issue with those actors, it's very much a NATO issue as well. Well, to repeat myself, that's one of the ways in which NATO has absorbed the problems of this region. And it demands, I would hope, extremely careful and cautious thinking at the present moment about what to do if that scenario arises, because it could be very sudden, you know, a health problem for Lukashenko, and suddenly you have a big crisis on your hands. So it's one we should be thinking about now.
Yeah, my final question is internal to Russia. You mentioned the December 2011 protests in Russia and the importance of Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny. As you say, waiting things, omens of the Russia that was not Putinist. Both are now dead. Do you think there's any internal hope for change in Russia?
Not a great deal. I don't know how much appetite there is for a very different country. It's a hard point to judge. There's a younger generation. You know, it's a very large country. It's very regionally diverse. And Putin has been in power for a long time. So that always creates a kind of appetite for something different, something new. But, you know, you don't see a kind of structured opposition movement in Russia. It would be difficult to function if it were there, but you don't see that. And you would need that in a way if there were to be big political changes. But the more significant point is that the really powerful institutions in Russia are the Kremlin, they're the security services, they're the military. And I can't imagine it being very easy to sort of get within those institutions. And whether or not there's a successor to Putin who can be found, and that's a very significant question, because maybe he's the only one who knows how to operate all of this machinery, that's an open question. But the machinery is going to be there. And the machinery is the machinery that's been created over the last 24 years. It goes back to Soviet times in some respects, and the 1990s as well. Boris Yeltsin concentrated a lot of power in the hands of the Russian president before Putin came on the scene. But that machinery is there. And I suspect, I mean, the guess I would have to make is that the next leader of Russia will be quite similar to Putin, and he will operate within an institutional framework, a kind of power political framework that's similar to the one that we see now. So my assessment, and these things are very often dramatically wrong, these kinds of predictions about the future, but my assessment is that what we have now is likely what we're going to have for quite a long time to come.
To wrap up, and because this is a podcast about books, I've asked my guests to choose two to recommend, one broadly from the same field, one anything, actually. So, Michael, what have you chosen?
So I'll take Margaret Macmillan's book, 1919, which is a book about, I think it has a different title in the UK, I'm not quite sure, but it's a title about the end of the First World War. And there are lots of pieces of the puzzle that are kind of haunting at the present moment. First of all, the nature of the conflict and the scale of it and what the diplomacy that came in its wake signified and meant. I think it's a remarkable book, but you also get details in that book that just stand out, such as there being no Ukrainian delegation at Versailles. There's a very powerful Polish delegation. Poland ends up with a nation state after the First World War. Ukraine does not. And that's, I think, helpful for thinking about where things have trended over the last 100 years. But that book is just a brilliant meditation on diplomacy, war, Europe, the kind of world, the world scene. And then, you know, I think Serhii Plokhii's book, The Russo-Ukrainian War, is a really eloquent and richly argued book about the historical context and background to the war. So, you know, that's one that I would recommend to readers who are looking a little bit more for, you could say, the local context of the war. Where does the war come from in Russian history? Where does it come from in the history of Ukraine, the history of Central Europe? And that's a book that's of the essence. So if you read Margaret MacMillan together with Serhii Bloki, you get 100 years and more of history that really, I think, illuminates the traumatic moment that we're living through.
Thank you. I think the MacMillan book is called Paris 1919 in the UK.
Yes.
I'll check that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, today I've been talking to Michael Kimmage about Collisions, published today as a Kindle book by Oxford University Press and out as a Dead Tree on March the 22nd. Michael, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you so much for taking the time and care to discuss this Dead Tree that's about to come out.
Right. Okay, we're done. Thank you very much for your time.